Descartes in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. Copyright 1996 by Paul Strathern. This unabridged recording of the reading of Descartes in 90 Minutes was published by arrangement with Ivan R. D. and was produced in 2002 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright there too. Neither this recording nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Robert Whitfield. This book is 80 pages long. The following material appears on the book's back cover. René Descartes spent most of his childhood in solitude, a situation that also came to characterize his adult life. Happily, these countless lonely hours helped Descartes produce the declaration that changed all philosophy. I think, therefore I am. Eventually convincing himself to doubt and disregard sensory knowledge, Descartes found he could prove his existence through his thoughts. This internal information, he believed, was the true reality. External forces were hopelessly deceiving. In Descartes in 90 Minutes, Paul Strathern offers a concise, expert account of Descartes' life and ideas, and explains their influence on man's struggle to understand his existence in the world. Descartes in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. Introduction. By the end of the 16th century, philosophy had stopped. It was Descartes who started it up again. Philosophy had begun for the first time in the 6th century BC in ancient Greece. 2 centuries later, it entered a golden era with Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. Then, for nearly 2,000 years, nothing happened. At least, nothing original happened. Nonetheless, several distinguished philosophers appeared during this period. The 3rd century Alexandrian Plotinus refined Plato's philosophy, in the process creating Neoplatonism. St. Augustine of Hippo then refined Neoplatonism to the point where it was acceptable to Christian theology. The Islamic scholar Averroes refined parts of Aristotle's philosophy, and Thomas Aquinas in turn rendered these acceptable to Christian theology. All 4 of these disparate figures advanced the course of philosophy, but not one of them produced an entirely new philosophy of his own. Their work was essentially exegesis, commentary and elaboration of the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle. In this way, these 2 pagan philosophers and their pagan philosophies became pillars of the Christian Church. This intellectual conjuring trick was the main foundation of scholasticism, the name given to philosophical activity during the Middle Ages. Scholasticism was the philosophy of the Church and prided itself on its lack of originality. New philosophical ideas resulted only in heresy, the Inquisition, and burning at the stake. The ideas of Plato and Aristotle gradually became buried beneath layers of religiously correct Christian commentary, and philosophy dried up. By the mid-15th century, this moribund stage had been reached in almost all fields of intellectual endeavor. The Church reigned supreme throughout the medieval world. But already the first cracks were beginning to appear in this vast edifice of intellectual certainty. Ironically, the main source of these cracks was the same classical world that had produced Plato and Aristotle. Much learning that had been lost or forgotten during the Dark Ages now began coming to light, inspiring a renaissance or rebirth of human knowledge. The Renaissance brought with it a new humanistic outlook. This was followed by the Reformation, which ended the hegemony of the Church. Yet more than 100 years after these developments had transformed Europe, philosophy remained stuck in the bog of scholasticism. This came to an end only with the arrival of Descartes, who produced a philosophy fit for the new era. In no time this spread through Europe and even achieved the ultimate accolade of being named after its founder, Cartesianism. Descartes' life and works. Descartes never did a stroke of useful work in his life. At various times he described himself as a soldier, a mathematician, a thinker, and a gentleman. The last comes closest to describing his attitude toward life, as well as his social status. His youthful inclination to a life of leisurely ease soon settled into a routine. He lived on his private income, rose at noon, and travelled when he felt like it. Such was his life. No dramas, no wives, no great public success or failure. Yet Descartes was indisputably the most original philosopher to appear in the 15 centuries following the death of Aristotle. By the time Descartes arrived on the scene, the Renaissance had brought a new humanistic outlook to Europe, and the Reformation had ended the hegemony of the Catholic Church. Yet it remained for Descartes to launch the modern age of philosophy. From this period on, the primacy of the individual and the analysis of human consciousness became fundamental to philosophy, a focus that has only recently been superseded by the primacy of the dictionary and analysis of its contents. René Descartes was born March 31, 1596, in the small town of La Haye, in the Creuse Valley, 30 miles south of Tours, France. This spot has now been renamed Descartes, and if you visit it, you can still see the house where he was born, and the 12th-century church of Saint-Georges, where he was baptized. René was the fourth child, and his mother was to die in childbirth the following year. His father, Joachim, was a judge in the High Court of Brittany. This met at Rennes, 140 miles away, which meant that Joachim was at home for less than half the year. He soon remarried, and René was brought up in the house of a grandmother. Here his main attachment was to his nurse, for whom he retained the fondest regard. He was to pay for her upkeep until the day she died. Descartes spent a solitary childhood, accentuated by his sickly nature, and he quickly learned to do without company. From his early years he is known to have been introspective and reserved. A wan-faced child with thick, curly black hair and large, shadow-ringed eyes, wandering through the orchard in his black coat and knee-breeches, a black, wide-brimmed hat on his head, and a long woolen scarf wound round his neck. At the age of 10 he was sent as a boarder to the Jesuit college that had recently opened in La Flèche. This school was intended for the education of the local gentry, who before this had often dispensed with such matters in favour of hunting, hawking, and half-hearted home homiletics. The rector of the college was a friend of the Descartes family, so the frail young René was given a room of his own and allowed to get up when he pleased. As with most who are permitted such a privilege, this meant that Descartes rose around noon, a habit he strictly adhered to for the rest of his life. While the other pupils were being browbeaten by vicious and conceited Jesuits, versed in the intricacies of scholasticism, the intelligent young Descartes was thus able to absorb his learning in a more relaxed atmosphere, rising in time for luncheon, followed by the riding, fencing, and flute-playing lessons that occupied the afternoon. By the time he came to leave, it was apparent that Descartes had learned far more than anyone else in the school, and his health appears to have completely recovered, apart from a lingering hypochondria which he carefully nursed throughout his remarkably healthy life. Yet despite carrying off all the prizes, Descartes retained a deep ambivalence toward his education. It seemed to him to be largely rubbish, rehashed Aristotle encrusted with centuries of interpretations, the stifling theology of Aquinas which had answers for everything but answered nothing, a morass of metaphysics. Nothing he learned appeared to have any certainty whatsoever, apart from mathematics, and in a life devoid of the certainties of home, family, and meaningful social contact, Descartes craved certainty in the only realm in which he felt at home, the intellect. He left school disappointed. Like Socrates before him, he was convinced he knew nothing. Even mathematics was only capable of providing impersonal certainty. The only other certainty he knew was God. When Descartes left La Flèche at 18, his father sent him to study law at the University of Poitiers. Joachim Descartes intended René to take up a respected position in the legal profession, just as his elder brother had done. In those days, such positions were filled largely by nepotism, a system that succeeded in producing approximately the same percentage of ludicrous and inadequate judges as today. But after spending 2 years studying the law, Descartes decided he had had enough of it. By this time, he had come into possession of a number of small rural properties inherited from his mother. These gave him a modest income, enough to live as he pleased. So he decided to set off for Paris to pursue his thoughts. Judge Joachim was not pleased. The Descartes were gentlemen and weren't expected to spend their time thinking. But there was nothing he could do about it. His son was now a free man. After 2 years, Descartes tired of his well-heeled bachelor existence in Paris. Despite devoting himself to a wide range of studies and composing a number of rather dilettantish treatises, he was becoming more and more involved in the social life of the capital, which he found utterly tedious. He withdrew to a quiet address in the Faubourg Saint-Germain, where no one went visiting, and lived in seclusion while pursuing his thoughts in peace. This was to be Descartes' favourite way of life throughout the rest of his years, yet after settling down for a few months, he suddenly bolted. He seems to have been driven by two finely balanced obsessions, solitude and travel. Never having felt close to his fellow men, he had no wish to live in their company, and never having had a real home, he felt no desire to create one for himself. He was forever restless and solitary. This makes Descartes' next move seem all the more extraordinary. He decided to join the army. In 1618 he went to Holland and signed on as an unpaid officer in the army of the Prince of Orange. The prince's Protestant army was preparing to defend the United Provinces of the Netherlands against the Catholic Spanish, who sought to retake their former colony. What the Dutch made of this aloof Catholic gentleman with no military experience, who professed to have done a bit of fencing and riding at school, is difficult to judge. At the time, Descartes spoke no Dutch, and stuck resolutely to his routine of rising at noon. Perhaps they just didn't notice him as he sat in his tent, composing a treatise on music or some such. Nowadays he would presumably be accused of being a spy, but in those days the military appear to have correctly gauged the importance of spies, and were willing to sign on any recruits, regardless of nationality, allegiance, or even willingness to participate in military routine. We do know that Descartes found himself bored by life in the army. In his view, there was too much idleness and dissipation. Does this mean there were officers who arose even later than he did? One afternoon, while strolling through the streets of Breda, Descartes noticed a poster being stuck up on a wall. In the manner of the time, it outlined an unsolved mathematical problem and challenged all comers to solve it. Descartes didn't quite understand the instructions. They were, after all, in Dutch. He turned to the Dutch gentleman standing beside him and asked if he could kindly translate. The Dutchman was unimpressed by this ignorant young French officer. He replied that he would translate the poster only if the Frenchman were willing to try to solve the problem and bring him his solution. The following afternoon, the young French officer arrived at the Dutchman's house, where to the Dutchman's surprise he found that the officer had not only solved the problem, but had done so in exceptionally brilliant fashion. According to Descartes' first biographer, Beye, this was how Descartes met Isaac Beeckman, the renowned Dutch philosopher and mathematician. The two were to remain close friends, corresponding regularly for the next 2 decades, with a few brief interruptions when they disagreed. "I was asleep until you wakened me," Descartes was to write to Beeckman. It was he who revived Descartes' interest in mathematics and philosophy, which had lain dormant since he had left La Flèche. After a year or so in the Dutch army, Descartes set off on a summer tour of Germany and the Baltic. He then decided to try another spell of army life and journeyed to the small town of Neuburg in southern Germany, where the army of Maximilian, Duke of Bavaria, was camped in its winter quarters on the upper reaches of the Danube. Army life here appears to have been as strenuous as ever for Descartes, who describes how he took up residence in fine, warm quarters, persisted in his habit of sleeping 10 hours a night and rising at noon, and spent his waking hours communing with my own thoughts. The political situation in Europe was now becoming serious, though it's difficult to deduce this from Descartes' attitude. The Bavarians had gone to war against Frederick V, the Elector Palatinate, and Protestant King of Bohemia. The entire continent was rapidly sliding into the long and disastrous conflict that came to be known as the 30 Years' War. This war, with its ever-changing fortunes affecting countries from Sweden to Italy, was to continue until virtually the end of Descartes' life, leaving large areas of Europe, especially in Germany, devastated and deserted. Yet the effect of this war on Descartes, even when he was in the army, appears to have been minimal. Still, one can't help suspecting that this persistent background of political uncertainty, together with Descartes' own psychological uncertainties, somehow contributed to the deep internal need for certainty that was to characterize his entire philosophy. Meanwhile, the Bavarian winter set in, and soon the snow lay round about deep and crisp and even. Descartes found it so cold, he claims that he took to living in a stove, a subject of much debate. Some claim that Descartes really meant a well-heated room, others that he meant something more like a sauna, but Descartes uses the French word brûle, which unquestionably means a stove. One day, while sitting in his stove, Descartes had a vision. It's not clear precisely what he saw under these rather steamed-up circumstances, but it seems that this vision contained a mathematical picture of the world. This convinced Descartes that the workings of the entire universe could be discovered by the application of some universal mathematical science. That night, when Descartes went to sleep, he had three vivid dreams. In the first, he found himself struggling against an overpowering wind, trying to make his way down the street toward the church at his old college in La Flèche. At one point, he turns to greet someone, and the wind flings him against the church wall. Then, from the middle of the courtyard, someone calls to him that a friend of his has a melon which he wants to give him. In the next dream, Descartes is overcome with terror, and hears a noise like a crack of lightning, after which the darkness of his room is filled with a myriad of sparks. The last dream is less clear. In the course of this, he sees a dictionary and a book of poetry on his desk. This is followed by a number of the usual inconsequential and highly symbolic happenings that never fail to delight the dreamer and bore his listener. Descartes then decides, in his dream, to interpret these happenings. This might have given us a deep insight into Descartes' understanding of himself, but unfortunately his biographer Bayet becomes rather garbled at this point. The events of that winter day and the following night, November the 11th, 1619, would have a profound and lasting effect upon Descartes. He believed that this vision and the ensuing dreams had revealed to him his God-given vocation. They were to give him a much-needed confidence in his calling, as well as in the correctness of its findings that was not always backed by argument. But for this experience, the brilliant dilettante might never have realized his vocation. It is ironic that Descartes, the great rationalist, should have found his inspiration in a mystical vision and highly irrational dreams. This element in Descartes' thinking is often overlooked in French lycées, where the great Gallic hero and hypnophile is held up as a rationalist exemplar. Descartes' dreams have attracted a wide variety of explanation. According to the Dutch philosopher and astronomer Huygens, who was later to correspond with Descartes, these dreams were the result of Descartes' brain becoming overheated while he was in the stove. Others have suggested indigestion, overwork, lack of sleep, a mystical crisis, or the fact that he might recently have joined the Rosicrucians. The melon, whose offstage existence is alluded to in the first dream, apparently caused much mirth to 18th-century readers of Descartes' biography, but with the advent of psychoanalysis this melon became a much more serious matter. As a result of his vision and the ensuing dreams, Descartes vowed that he would now dedicate his life to his intellectual studies, and would make a pilgrimage of thanksgiving to the shrine of Our Lady of Loreto in Italy. So it comes as rather a surprise when we learn that instead he continued drifting aimlessly about Europe for another 7 years, though he did manage to visit Loreto 5 years later. We have few precise details of Descartes' life during this 7-year period of vagabond life, as he called it. To begin with, he seems to have joined the Imperial Hungarian Army. But the 30 Years' War had now begun in earnest, and Gentleman Officer Descartes appears to have been none too keen for active campaigning. After leaving the army, he travelled through France, Italy, Germany, Holland, Denmark, and Poland, all the time skilfully circumnavigating the regions where the war was being conducted by more dedicated members of his profession. Not that Descartes was able to avoid violence altogether. While visiting one of the Frisian islands, possibly Schiermonnikoog, he hired a boat to take him to the mainland. The sailors mistook him for a rich French merchant and planned to rob him along the way. As Descartes stood on deck, watching the low island shoreline recede across the grey sea, the sailors working the ropes jabbered among themselves in Dutch, scheming how to hit him on the head, toss him overboard, and ransack the gold which they felt sure was hidden in his trunk. But their passenger had by now picked up a smattering of Dutch during his travels, and the hapless Schiermonnikoogers found themselves confronted by a dashing Descartes brandishing his sword. They quickly backed down, promising to transport him to the mainland in safety. Sometime during this period, probably in 1623, Descartes returned home to La Haye and sold all his property. He then invested the cash in bonds, which were to provide him with a sound income for the rest of his life. One would think that during the course of this trip he might have stopped to see his family, but this is far from certain. Descartes never actually quarrelled with his family, but he remained utterly detached from them. Despite his freedom to roam Europe at will, he didn't bother to return home for the weddings of his brother or his sister, and he did not even visit his father on his deathbed. Toward the end of this period, Descartes spent an increasing amount of time in Paris. Here he met an old school friend from La Flèche, Marin Mersenne, who had joined the church. Father Mersenne had become a highly respected man of learning, in contact with the great minds of Europe. From Paris, Mersenne corresponded with such figures as Pascal, Fermat, and Gassendi. Mersenne's cell became a sort of clearing-house for the latest ideas in mathematical, scientific, and philosophic thinking. This was just the kind of friend Descartes needed, and he was to correspond with Mersenne for the rest of his life, sending him manuscripts and testing his ideas on him both for their validity and to determine whether they conflicted with the teachings of the Church. Descartes spent most of his time in Paris, closeted in his room, studying. Occasionally friends would come round to discuss ideas with him. Sometimes he was even persuaded out to more formal occasions. An anecdote relates how he was present at the residence of the papal nuncio when a certain Chandu delivered a talk outlining a new philosophy. At the end of the talk, Descartes proceeded to dismember this new philosophy with the aid of some rigorous mathematical reasoning, to which Chandu had no reply. After following Descartes' skilful arguments, Cardinal de Bérulle took him aside and strongly advised him to devote his life to philosophy. For some reason, this counsel appeared to win over Descartes. Visions and dreams may have inspired confidence in him, but it took the rational approach to urge him toward decisive action. In 1628, he retired to the north of France to live in seclusion and devote himself entirely to his thinking. Unfortunately, his Parisian friends continued to visit him, so Descartes journeyed even farther afield and went to live in isolation in Holland, where he settled for more than 2 decades, until the year before his death. But settled is very much a relative term where Descartes is concerned. During the first 15 years of his residence in Holland, he is known to have changed houses at least 18 times. In between, when the settled domestic routine became all too much for him, he frequently travelled abroad. Only Father Mersenne could keep up with his address. This constant movement is put down to Descartes' love of solitude, but it seems to speak of some deeper restlessness. In the course of travelling, or even moving his home, one can't help meeting people, even if only in passing fashion. This unending movement suggests that Descartes' solitude was not entirely self-sufficient. He was lonely, but found it impossible to make contact with people except in the most trivial manner. Descartes always had servants, and he appears to have cut quite a personable figure. The portraits we have of him depict a pale-faced gentleman in the dark, flowing wig of the period. His mustachioed, drip-bearded features have a certain saturnine charm. He is said to have dressed well in fashionable knee breeches, black silk stockings, and silver buckle shoes. A silk scarf was always around his neck to protect it from the cold, and whenever he went out he wore a woollen scarf and heavy coat, and always put on his sword. He is said to have been sensitive to the slightest change of temperature, which he claimed affected the inherited weakness of his chest. Yet he spent years travelling throughout Europe, from Italy to Scandinavia, and the country he finally chose to live in was Holland, notorious for its rain, fog, and ice, which a contemporary French visitor described as 4 months of winter, followed by 8 months of cold. Or perhaps this was just the ideal spot for a dedicated hypochondriac. But Holland had one great advantage. In the 17th century, it was the duty-free zone of the European mind. Unlike in other nations, here you didn't have to pay for your ideas. The tolerant Dutch had dispensed with such heavy-duty items as the Inquisition, heresy, the rack, and burning at the stake, critical accolades that greeted original thinkers elsewhere in Europe. Of the four great thinkers who produced original philosophy during the 17th century, no less than three, Descartes, Spinoza, and Locke, lived for periods in Holland. The other, Leibniz, lived across the border in Hanover, and visited Holland several times. Partly as a result of this liberal atmosphere, Holland also became a thriving centre of the printing industry, with works by such advanced thinkers as Galileo and Hobbes being published there. It was a time when new ideas thrived in Holland as nowhere else in Europe. Descartes began this productive period of his life with high hopes. As a result of his vision in the Bavarian stove, he had conceived of a universal science capable of embracing all human knowledge. This would arrive at truth by the use of reason. But this was much more than just a revolutionary new method. Reason had played very much a backseat role in the sciences and alchemies of the Middle Ages. Descartes had conceived of a system that would not only include all knowledge, but also unite it. This system would be free from prejudices and assumptions, and would be based on certainty alone. It would start from basic principles, which were themselves self-evident, and would build from these. Descartes foresaw immense advantages from his system. He confidently predicted that when this new scientific method was applied to medicine, it would be able to slow the aging process. This was Descartes' persistent dream. 10 years later he wrote to the Dutch scholar Huygens that, despite his parlous physical condition, he expected to live until he was well over 100, though in the last decade of his life he revised this estimate downward by a few years. Descartes began writing a treatise that he called Rules for the Direction of the Mind. In order to discover the universal science, he argued, we first had to adopt a method of thinking properly. This method consisted of following two rules of mental operation, intuition and deduction. Intuition, Descartes defined as the conception, without doubt, of an unclouded and attentive mind, which is formed by the light of reason alone. Deduction was defined as necessary inference from other facts which are known for certain. Descartes' celebrated method, which came to be known as the Cartesian method, lay in the correct application of these two rules of thought. Descartes was now gaining a reputation as a thinker on a wide range of philosophical and scientific subjects. In March 1629, the Pope and certain senior cardinals began observing UFOs in the sky above Rome. As the sun set, a solar halo would appear with orbiting spots of brilliant light. Letters were sent to Descartes and various other leading thinkers asking their opinion of these visions. Descartes was so intrigued that for a time he gave up his philosophical thinking to concentrate on this matter. He had his suspicions about the cause of such phenomena, but refused to commit himself until several years later. By this time he had completed an entire treatise on the subject. Meanwhile, one Vatican source had offered its own explanation. The phenomena were caused by angels undertaking celestial scene changes in preparation for the second coming. Descartes suggested that these lights in the sky were caused by meteors. Unfortunately, modern scientists have an explanation that sounds even more implausible than the Vatican's. These phenomena, now called parhelia, are said to be caused when the sun shines through a thin cloud composed of hexagonal ice crystals falling with their principal axes vertical. Crystals performing formation dances in the atmosphere are now considered much more likely than angels, and simplistic explanations such as Descartes' are laughed out of court. In this, as in many other matters, Descartes was alive during a brief and possibly unique era of human thought. The new explanations put forward by the finest scientific and philosophical minds of his time were in many cases both plausible and comprehensible. They also tended to be rational and, in their overall conception, simple, with the aim of leaving space for the contemplation of ultimate mysteries. Humanity is unlikely to experience such an era again. Afterward, it would become increasingly impossible to understand the truth, except in the narrowing field that one was capable of understanding. From now on, we were to know more and more about less and less. Having laid down his rules for the working of the mind, Descartes now set about the outer world. For the next 3 years, he composed a treatise on the universe. This contained his ideas on an enormous range of scientific subjects, including meteors, dioptrics, and geometry. In order to pursue his studies in anatomy, he now took to visiting the local slaughterhouse, returning home with various specimens hidden under his cloak so that he could dissect them in private. As a result of this work, Descartes originated the study of embryology. According to legend, on one of these visits to the abattoir, Descartes noticed a portly young man sketching the flayed carcass of an ox, and asked him why he had chosen such a subject. "Your philosophy takes away our souls," replied the artist. "In my paintings I will give them back, even to dead animals." The young artist is said to have been Rembrandt. After 3 years of concentrated work, Descartes prepared to send the manuscript of his treatise on the universe to Father Mersenne for publication in Paris. Then, like a bolt from the blue, fantastic news arrived from Rome. Galileo had been charged with heresy, brought before the Inquisition, and forced to swear that he abjured, cursed, and detested his scientific works. Most specifically, this referred to his belief in Copernicus's theory that the Earth moved around the Sun. Descartes immediately asked his friend Beeckmann for a copy of Galileo's work, and found to his dismay that many of Galileo's conclusions were identical to his own. Without a word to anyone, Descartes put away his treatise on the universe and turned his thoughts to less controversial matters. The work was not published until years after Descartes' death, and then only in part. Descartes' life was riven by dichotomies. He longed for peace and solitude, yet his loneliness drove him to obsessive travel. As a daringly original thinker, he vowed to follow my thoughts wherever they might lead. Yet as a man, he swore to obey the laws of my country, adhere to the religion of my fathers, and follow the example of the wisest men I meet. He was convinced that what he had written in his treatise on the universe was correct, yet he also firmly believed in the God of the Church. Descartes has been accused of cowardice, of being a secret atheist, and of not even knowing himself despite all his introspective meditations. None of these accusations stand. Descartes may not have been of the stuff of martyrs, but that doesn't make him a coward. He was convinced that without dropping any of its scholastic tenets, the Church could still come round to his point of view, and his intellectual self-knowledge was deeper than that of any philosopher since Socrates, even if it did contain a few psychological blind spots. Yet the greatest dichotomy that beset Descartes lay in his philosophy. Descartes saw the world as consisting of two kinds of substance, mind and matter. Mind was unextended and indivisible. Matter was extended and divisible, and obeyed the laws of physics. This meant that our incorporeal mind was lodged in a mechanistic body. But how could the mind, which had no extension, interact with a body which could only obey the mechanistic laws of science? Descartes never satisfactorily solved this problem, which so uncannily echoes the psychological dichotomies that beset him in daily life. Yet he did try to produce an answer. According to Descartes, the mind and the body interact in the pineal gland, an obscure organ near the base of the brain, whose precise function remains uncertain to this day. Unfortunately, Descartes rather missed the point here. The question was not so much where they interact, but how. A rare human element now enters Descartes' life. He has an affair with a girl named Hélène, who may have been one of his servants. As a result, he has a daughter whom he calls Francine. After the birth of Francine, Hélène lives with her daughter in a nearby house, but visits him regularly. When others are present, Descartes passes off Francine as his niece. From these few facts, it is difficult to know for certain what kind of relationship he had with Hélène, but it's easy enough to conjecture. Poor Hélène, what did she make of this upper-class cold fish with the emotional range of a filleted cod? What did she register when she gazed into those shadow-ringed, abstracted eyes of his? Hélène may not have been able to break through to Descartes, but Francine certainly did. Guilelessly she reached out to him, and he responded. It wasn't so much that he'd been rejected in his childhood. There was just no one there, except old Nanny with her potato love. Despite attempting to pass Francine off as his niece, Descartes soon grew to love his little daughter, and she offered him a unique emotional experience in his life. He was now writing what is today considered his most original work, his Discourse on Method. Ironically, the body of this book consisted of safer portions lifted from his treatise on the universe. These contained ideas that were to change the face of mathematics and make several revolutionary advances in science. In this work, Descartes laid the foundations of modern analytic geometry and introduced coordinates, later to be named Cartesian coordinates by Leibniz. In optics, he proposed the law of diffraction and put forward an explanation of the rainbow. And he attempted a rational scientific theory to explain the weather, which, like our present theories, ended up only working retrospectively. But far and away the most important part of the Discourse on Method is the comparatively brief introduction. This outlines the thinking that was to change the course of philosophy, and in an even more revolutionary departure from tradition, Descartes makes these ideas both comprehensible and readable. How is it possible to convey profoundly original philosophical insights with sufficient clarity so that anyone can understand them? This problem has defeated most of the great minds of philosophy. Plato cracked it by setting out his philosophy in the form of dinner party conversations. Nietzsche thought he'd cracked it by writing the most brilliant, subtle, and powerful prose ever penned in German, but his megalomania turned into pure mania. Wittgenstein attempted to circumvent the problem by allowing for the attention span of the TV age, and writing brilliant two-line remarks. But he refused to back them up with philosophic argument. Descartes succeeded in overcoming this problem by the simplest and most obvious method of all. In clear, autobiographical prose, he describes how he goes about his thinking, and the thoughts that occur to him in the process. When you read Descartes, you experience what it is like to be a great mind thinking original philosophy. And he describes this so deceptively well that you think it's easy. It appears no different from the way you might think. Step by rational step, you follow him to his conclusion. Descartes begins by taking the reader back to snow-covered Bavaria and the time of his vision. Winter set in, and I found myself in a spot where there was no society of any interest. At the time I was unworried by any cares or passions, so I took to spending my day in a stove where I could be alone with my thoughts. In surprisingly cool prose, he then goes on to describe how it is possible, by means of persistent and determined doubt, for us to destroy our belief in the entire fabric of the world around us. Nothing remains certain. The whole universe, our very individuality, even our own existence, may all be a dream. We have no way of knowing anything for certain. Except for one thing. No matter how deluded I may be in my thoughts about myself and the world, there is just one thing that is undeniable. I am thinking. This alone proves to me my existence. In the most famous remark in philosophy, Descartes concludes, "Cogito ergo sum." I think, therefore I am. Having established his one ultimate certainty, Descartes proceeds to rebuild upon this foundation all that he has doubted. The world, the truths of mathematics, the snowbound Bavarian winter, all return with cold certainty, chastened by their period of banishment to the never-never land of doubt, but more indubitable than ever now that they are built on such an indubitable foundation. Having had the courage to doubt the entire universe, Descartes typically chose to publish his work anonymously. He also published it in French, in the hope of reaching a wider audience. He wished to avoid controversy with the Church, and hoped to do so by appealing to people who were interested in the new sciences. Astonishingly, this almost worked. Almost. People soon determined the author of Discourse on Method, but at first they were more interested in its mathematical and scientific theories. Descartes revolutionized the field of optics by discovering the law of refraction, but his advances in geometry were even more revolutionary. Here he introduced the notion of coordinates, to this day known as Cartesian coordinates after him. These enabled the identification of a fixed point by reference to a horizontal and a vertical plane. He also introduced algebra to solve geometric problems, thus founding analytic geometry. Mathematicians were fascinated, then outraged. For most of us, the one certain thing about mathematics is that it's either correct or incorrect. Such a naive approach immediately disqualifies one from the realm of true mathematicians. Having read Descartes' new mathematical theories and recognized their profound originality, all the great mathematicians of the era were soon gunning for him. Gassendi, Pascal, Inson, Fermat, one by one they entered the fray. Such controversies are well beyond the comprehension of mere mortals. Those who believe otherwise may find the old story of Fermat's last theorem instructive. According to this, there are no whole numbers above 2, such that the following expression is true: x to the power of n plus y to the power of n equals z to the power of n. Shortly before Fermat died, he wrote in the margin beside this formula, "I have discovered a truly remarkable proof for this, but there's no room to write it down here." Despite repeated attempts by many of the finest mathematical minds of the past 3 centuries, not until the 1990s has someone at last managed to find a proof for Fermat's last theorem. Even this has been disputed. For centuries, many mathematicians maintained that Fermat's last theorem couldn't possibly be true. Others, that it must be. Some are convinced that Fermat was bluffing. Still others that he didn't dare try to prove it. Mathematics begins in certainty and ends like this. Philosophy, on the other hand, both begins and ends like this. When someone is described as having a philosophical attitude, you can be sure he's not a philosopher. This Descartes quickly discovered. After the mathematicians, it was the philosophers' turn to attack him. In no time, Descartes found himself in trouble with the Church. If you could doubt everything except the fact that you were thinking, where did this leave God? Fortunately, Descartes' friends rallied to defend him, and even more fortunately, Descartes was living in Holland. Or rather, moving in Holland. In 1638, for the 15th time since taking up residence in the Netherlands, Descartes moved his home once again, this time to Amersfoort, just outside the ancient university city of Utrecht. By now his daughter Francine was 5 years old, and he was planning to send her to France so that she could become a fine lady. This book is continued on Disc 2.